from KCRW. I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
The footage was literally like, it's worth more than my life, because if I just went out without the footage, what's the point of being there and being our life for any second?
Filmmaker Wad Al-Khatib spent her early 20s living inside a besieged Syrian hospital, documenting the brutal reality and the moments of joy and humanity of everyday life in Aleppo. When she finally was forced to flee in the dark of night with her husband and infant daughter Sama, she was determined to smuggle 12 hard drives of footage past a Syrian checkpoint. After Al-Khatib made it out, the UK's Channel 4 introduced her to filmmaker Edward Watts. Together, they carved an extraordinary 90-minute video diary out of more than 500 hours of footage. Al-Khatib dedicated the project to her daughter, and the film For Sama is now Oscar-nominated for Best Documentary. Al-Khatib and Watts tell us about spending 2 years crafting For Sama and the aha moment that inspired the final version. But first on the News Banter, Hollywood is queasy as Disney continues to obliterate Fox. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my colleague in Banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So we have just been informed in the last few days that Emma Watts, who was running 20th Century Studios, which had become a part of Disney when Disney acquired Fox, obviously it used to be 20th Century Fox, they changed the name, they're sort of defoxing Fox. And part of that is this departure of Emma Watts in this job running what had been the storied Fox Film Studio. It's now a Disney label that I don't even know that what its purpose is exactly. She is leaving less than a year after the merger closed in March 2019. It's not shocking, but it nonetheless, I think, has rattled Hollywood.
Yeah, this is an executive that is really well-liked, and people like Ryan Reynolds and Josh Gad, the actor, and Steven Spielberg, of all people, have put out statements, and you never see that when executives lose their jobs or move elsewhere. And I think it's because she was known as a champion for talent, and there's a lot of anxiety around Hollywood right now about Disney and its acquisition of Fox. They came in, they said, we love the Fox people, we want to make the Fox-style movies, and slowly over this past year, they've backed away from that, and several people have left. And the thinking that I'm hearing from Disney is they're not interested in these kinds of movies that Emma Watts made, like Ford v. Ferrari, or even Deadpool, or The Martian with Matt Damon. Those are kind of upper budgeted, riskier adult dramas. They want the movies that are guaranteed or almost guaranteed to make $1 billion. And if you don't deliver that at Disney, you better look for the door.
Yeah, and you don't deliver lunchboxes and T-shirts and things that they want to sell with their giant marketing machine. Just to mention some of the films that Emma was there for when she was at this top job, you know, it was an array of things that could have fit at Disney. Maybe Night at the Museum, maybe a little too irreverent, I don't know, for Disney. Bohemian Rhapsody, as you said, The Martian. You know, she did have Dark Phoenix, which was a tremendous failure, and Bob Iger pointed that out when he was trying to justify some earnings numbers that had hurt the bottom line. But the other thing that I think makes certain people feel a little queasy about this is that not only was Fox a legacy studio, but it was run essentially by women. Stacey Snyder ran it with Emma Watts. There was Elizabeth Gabler, who ran the very successful Fox 2000 label, and Disney abruptly pulled the plug on that just as the merger was closing. Having said they wouldn't do that, they then did it, which seemed to a lot of people irrational, given its track record with movies like that kind of thing that you're talking about don't necessarily sometimes generated huge numbers, but, you know, things like Devil Wears Prada or, you know, Fault in Our Stars, very, very successful, but maybe not, I don't know, the Disney brand may be narrower than Disney thought it was.
Right, and I think all eyes right now are on Searchlight, which is formerly Fox Searchlight, the specialty division that has been very successful in winning awards and having these kinds of Oscar-oriented breakout films. Disney has said very nice things. Iger himself has said that he loves Fox Searchlight and loves what they've done and built that brand. But who knows now? I mean, Nancy Utley is another female executive who co-runs Fox Searchlight. They have Jojo Rabbit in the race this year, probably not going to win Best Picture. Is there a future at Disney for this kind of specialty division?
Yeah, and I'll note that you just said Fox Searchlight a couple of times because old habits really do die hard. And this is part of what is shaking Hollywood up so much, even though everyone knew going in that there was probably no place for someone like Emma Watts at Disney. Let me just transition to a story of global concern, which is this coronavirus epidemic. obviously, there are many, many things to worry about with this outbreak. But certainly in terms of box office in China, it's devastating.
Yeah, this has really been a catastrophic hit to the film business in that country. And obviously, it's a health crisis and there are bigger things to think about. But for the purposes of the entertainment business, I mean, last year, the Lunar New Year weekend, which kicks off the biggest movie-going weekend in China, $500 million in gross receipts last year. This year, $2 million. And that's just the beginning. About 7,000 theaters have been closed in that country. No sign when they're going to be reopened. There are a bunch of films that are now backlogged because they have not been released there. And we're starting to get into the season where Hollywood tentpole type films will start to be rolled out. The Oscar-winning films, the summer movies. And there's a real question as to whether those films are going to get China releases this year.
So some people are estimating a $2 billion hit. And I don't even know how you can say that because this is such an unfolding story. And who knows where this virus is going. I will note that one weird beneficiary of the whole thing is Steven Soderbergh's film Contagion, which now has suddenly become a hit again because of interest, I guess, inspired by this outbreak.
Yeah, there's a lot of similarities. I mean, both started in China. There is a flu-oriented element to both of them. But, you know, it's one of those weird things where Hollywood seems to have kind of predicted something that happens in the real world. And they did a lot of science. They did a lot of research for that movie when it came out, according to the filmmakers.
Yeah, the other piece of entertainment that has been invoked a lot on social media is Chernobyl in China and here, because even if you don't want to watch all of Chernobyl, which is an award-winning HBO series, even if you watch the first 10 or 15 minutes, you get it, because this pattern of there is a fact, which is that the core of this nuclear reactor has been exposed and is a disaster, and there's these bureaucrats who are unqualified and not experts saying, you know, no, it's fine. It's fine. It didn't happen. And I think that that is how some Chinese perceive the response of the government there. And really, the resonance to China and elsewhere at this point is unmistakable. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. The Oscar-nominated documentary, Forsama, begins with a close-up of an infant wrapped in a pink and white blanket. Her mom is behind the camera and singing a lullaby.
Sama, mama, mama.
Before long, her song is interrupted by the ominous sound of low-flying aircraft.
Mama, sama.
Such moments had become routine in the life of Wad Al-Khatib, her husband Hamza, and their daughter Sama. Al-Khatib filmed her husband, a doctor, as he struggled to save lives in East Aleppo under constant bombardment from the Assad regime, as well as the Russians. Circumstances became increasingly dire as pro-Assad forces began targeting hospitals and schools. But Al-Khatib was determined to stay in Aleppo and keep her camera rolling. Al-Khatib had left her home in the Syrian countryside at 18 to study at the University of Aleppo. 2 years later, in 2011, the Syrian revolution began. At a time when it seemed there was a chance for real change, Al-Khatib started filming activists at her university. Eventually, she left school and moved to East Aleppo to document the civilian resistance against Bashar al-Assad, who would unleash bombs and chemical weapons on his own people. When Al-Khatib joined us in the studio, along with her collaborator on Forsama, documentarian Edward Watts, she remembered having to move into a hospital a few years after the war began.
I was alone there with no parents, with no cousins. So I felt the hospital is the only place where I can be as a single woman there. And with the time, I started to understand really what filming mean and how I should improve myself, my equipment, and start to even feel that this is not just a temporary life. I should now settle down. I should
settle down here in the hospital.
Exactly. You should live, because I don't know if this life could be years or could be just months. So that's where I fell in love. I don't know if I felt in love because that feeling, or I had that feeling because I was always I felt
when you're
in
talking
love.
About falling in love, yeah. You're talking about literally falling in love with the doctor Hamza, who became your husband.
Exactly.
Right. So Channel 4 is about to make its entrance into this story at some point, and yeah. And you'll help me, Edward, figure this out. But you had a relationship because of what you had been doing some work for them.
So, for the news, yeah.
Yeah, I after the interfere of the Russian in 2015, most of these like channels outside, the international channels like CNN, BBC, Channel 4, and all of these people, they weren't able anymore to send
right, they couldn't journalists get somebody in there, right.
And the Turkish border was like completely closed. The Russian air forces started to be on the ground. So no one was able to send his own like stuff there.
Right.
So they started to look for citizen journalists or local journalists right. who they are living in that place and who could provide them with some material.
Right.
And I had a clip on YouTube. So Channel 4 News saw that clip and they contacted me personally and they said, will you be interested to send us some more material? And that's when I started working with them.
I mean, you had the ability, despite all of the chaos that you were living in, to get the material out of the country.
Yeah, it was just through Dropbox. You are able to send some clips, but also it takes sometimes days for, I don't know, like 2 minutes story. So it wasn't easy, but at least you have a window for the world outside.
And did you know each other at that point? Was that the beginning?
No, I was aware of Wad's work because I've been following the revolution since it began. So I knew of her. I'd seen the reports on Channel 4 News. I'm an independent filmmaker, but I've done a lot for Channel 4. So I knew those guys. But yeah, we only met for the first time after the tragic events in the film had finished.
So you, meanwhile, you're shooting and shooting and shooting. I don't know that you had a crystal clear or even a muddy idea of what you thought you were going to be doing with all of these hours of footage.
Yeah, I had no idea. I was so aware that this is so important. The only thing I had in my mind that I don't know if I will make it out or not. And for that reason, I was just like, keep filming and filming and filming. Even when I was pregnant, when I had my wedding, everything was happening more and more. I was like, this is could be ended at any second and just capture this real life under all that bad circumstances. People out need to see this.
Right.
And even when I worked with Channel 4 News, they had no idea what I was doing out of this like small clips, which I was sending them. So after we were displaced, we had a chance like to chat more online about what I was doing. And then they were interested to bring me to the UK to present some of the news work that we've done together. So they wanted like for me to be out to bring all the material that I have.
And then little did they know, they realized it was like more than 500 hours.
Yeah.
Exactly. And they were first when they started the conversation, it was about 15 minutes for the news.
Okay.
And when I showed them like this, like 12 hard drives, they were like, no, this is where we need to be. Like, it's maybe hours. And that's why they brought Ed to the conversation. Yeah. And we met the first time we start like how we want to like transfer this whole material to a film right. or to something really.
So make it into a thing. But exactly. So, but when you're in Aleppo at that point, how are you being even supported? How are you getting your whatever equipment?
So I had like in 2011 and 12 was like my phone first and then a very small Sony camera. And then 2013, I had like Canon 550 and then Sony a little bit bigger. And then I have Canon 70. It was the last
and
camera.
And who's telling
I had.
You, like, you should get this?
It's not you should. This is the only, like, my cousin gave me the Sony, the small one, so I got it.
I'll take it.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then another local channel, they were trying to support people who could film, and I got this kind of like 550. And when I got it, I have no idea how to use it. As many mistakes I did through these years, my footage started to be like, became better. And then, like, I had one mic through the whole years. I have one broken tripod. I have one battery. I have no lighting. But through the years, you know, like, just like, I've never been aware how important was everything I was trying to do until we will get out and I saw the whole material next to each other.
You didn't really have a sense that it was going to be what it became.
Yeah, I know it's like too much, but I've never felt like how it could be, you know, like even the personal stuff which we have.
Right, like your wedding and whatnot.
Yeah, it was like a one folder like called private and I was throwing everything inside this. And I've never thought how much I have from this until like we sat together and we start like watching this material. And I filmed that personal material, kind of the wedding and this stuff, because every woman wants to right. film that. But also other places where I just was putting the camera and speaking out to the camera all my fears and everything I was going through. It was just like something for me. For,
like a diary.
Yeah. And in case I was killed, there's someone who can really save this material and see the story and show it out for the people.
And meanwhile, you're in this very chaotic environment where you can be sitting there 1 minute and the next minute it's just this catastrophic attack and you're in this hospital. So I'm basically wondering, you're there with, you've got a mic and this and that. I mean, I think at one point you even say that you got yelled at by your future husband. Yeah. I mean, were they saying, get out of my way? Or are they just saying, you're right, this is worth it. We're going to make it work. How is that part working?
Because I lived in that hospital for years, I was really like, I knew exactly where should I stand and what usually doctors do in these cases. Because I'm so tiny and I can be just like, you know, in one corner.
Right.
But I know how people like do these stages because I filmed, for example, in an operation room, maybe more than 50 operations. I filmed it from minute one to the end. So I know exactly, you know, like if something urgent happened, I know what who's coming to this and this is first and this is second. So I was able to save like
the system of how that surgeries were going to. So you meanwhile, Edward, you're watching and thinking, I now have a medical degree because I've seen so many surgeries.
Something like that. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right.
Also like, you know, all this stuff, we live together. So like they are so open to tell me about like get out or don't come or whatever. And at the same time, they knew how important is this footage to be like recorded.
Right.
The fact that also the hospital itself was under attack, you know, so right. It's all like
this is a continuing
coming together.
Thing.
We have also that trust because I wasn't a journalist coming to the hospital to film and leave. I was living with them. So they knew that I will not like publish any of this material in case it was really risk the place where we live in. And literally the main thing, because I was too tiny. So really I can like move between them in very like good way.
Coming up after a short break, Forsama director Waad Al-Khatib tells us how she smuggled 12 hard drives of footage out of Syria in the dead of night, pregnant and holding her baby on her lap. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to Waad Al-Khatib and Edward Watts, directors of the Oscar-nominated documentary Forsama. Shot by Al-Khatib in a devastated Syria, the film is a co-production of PBS's Frontline and Channel 4 in the UK. It's currently streaming on Frontline's website. Forsama is a portrait of day-to-day life in East Aleppo, starting with the uprising against the regime in 2011. With Assad bombing and using chemicals on his own people, Al-Khatib and her family endured in the midst of horrific death and destruction. But still, life went on. Al-Khatib became a wife and a mother. Forsama captures attempts at normalcy and even joyous moments despite the brutality of the war. Even when Al-Khatib had opportunities to leave with her infant daughter, Sama, she was determined to stay to document what was happening in her country. And her husband, Hamza, a doctor at the last remaining hospital in the area, was desperately needed. But by 2016, Al-Khatib and her family were forced to flee.
There was no negotiation with anything. They will come to kill you or you need to leave. So in this way, we couldn't really know what should we do. What should we bag? What should we take? For me, it was like, yeah, Hamza, me and Sama, the most important things to get out. But also at the same time, for me, was the footage. And the footage was literally like, it's worth more than my life. Because if I just went out without the footage, what was the point? Yeah, what the point of being there and being our life for any second? Literally, the only thing I come to our mind, and I has so long conversation with Hamza about how to do this, just putting this archive with me and get out with them, because if I just put them in the car or with someone else, I'm not sure if they will get out safely or not. So I put them all in one bag and I wear it in the opposite way as like bag, but from the other side.
Like almost like a baby carrier.
Exactly. And I was like all...
That's
like
very symbolic, isn't it?
Yeah. And I was 3 months pregnant with my second one. And then I wear like my big coat. And then someone was sitting over all this. And I think now I was so crazy how I did that. But there was no other option for us to get out. And we were lucky enough. And really, I can't take any credit for this. But God and destiny can do that, because the only thing why we went out safe was just like because of our destiny. And there was 3 checkpoints, one by the Russian, one by the Syrian regime, and one by the Iranians. And at that time, because when we reached that place, it was 4 a.m. in the morning, and it was snowing, as you've seen in the film. And they opened the car. They said, like, one woman, one child, and one man. And then they said, like, go. And we make it out in this way.
And then they just waved you through.
Yeah.
There was no real clear idea that they would, because, that you guys had been not exactly trying to help the regime at all. So, yes.
And so many events happened through this displacement. They stopped the buses who was crossing the area. And I don't know how many people have been like arrested, and there's 11 people who've been killed through that way. So, you know, like they could do anything.
Just and no a one, roll of the dice yeah. that you got through. So then here comes Fouad with all this stuff.
Yes.
And somebody, at Channel 4 calls you and says...
Yeah. That was it, yeah. I've been talking for years about Syria and about the revolution there and about how important I thought it was for us to tell stories about these guys, the peaceful protesters. So anyway, I've been banging on about that for years. And so when they realized that WAD had this extraordinary archive, but no one, as she said, knew exactly what it was. I remember when I got the call, my colleague who put us together literally said that. She was like, we have no idea what form this should take, how long it should be. We just don't know what it is.
So how do you reach the idea of that it is going to be this personal kind of diary? They're looking at each other. Those of you who can only
hear this.
It's
a short answer.
Yeah,
short
our
answer.
Secret answer is yeah. like, yeah.
2 years. It's a two-word answer.
Just like that, 2 years, yeah. we're done,
years.
We got it.
That is how long it takes to sculpt something like this and to get to its essence, but retain its essence as well, because that's such a hard thing when you've got 500 hours that you're turning into 90 minutes.
Did you ever think, well, we're going to do the series?
No. We knew from minute one that, yeah, we will make it as a cinema. And we needed first to build our trust between each other because we've never met. And how I can really like find that guy who's like totally different, but at the same time, we could share the same like...
passion, commitment.
That goal, yeah, yeah. That we can like be both believe in this film and want to do it in the best way. I wanted really to be very true, very honest and very real. As a person who lived through that, I was so worried about that guy who will come, you know, from different background.
Right.
You know, there's been quite a few instances of like people going and taking footage, you know, or like collecting footage that was shot on the ground and then turning it into the films that they wanted it to be. And I think that was what was so yeah. important from the beginning, was that we should have a true collaboration. And, you know,
I should be the voice, you know, like I should be really presenting what I want, like
right.
what I've seen, what I've experienced. And I really like respect our relationship, because it took us time first to like start a very honest conversation.
Did you say, listen here, pal, let me explain something to you.
We had quite a few like, conversations along
those lines. I've been through war and you don't want to.
We've never had
but
that
I had the
clear
respect.
Thing. Yeah.
I was trying to make her see that actually I had that respect from her. The way I can best sum it up is she always had a veto, you know, because I felt my job was to almost like a translator, you know, to take this extraordinary story and footage and turn it into a form that people in LA or London or Paris or Cannes or wherever, they would be able to go there and connect with it and understand it and feel it. So I would argue strongly coming from that point of view, but if she really was unpersuadable,
yeah.
it was her story. And so she had the power to say, Ed, no.
Ed, no.
Ed, no.
And I don't know, did you do that a lot or a little?
We had that argument in every frame, but like I didn't do it like a lot because I had no experience before. This is for me is my life. So of course, what I want to see in the film is reflect to that experience. But at the same time, I know really when he says something, it's about how important for people to understand that
right.
from the other point of view, you know? So it was really like, at the beginning was a little bit hard between each other, but then after like 4 months of working, we started really both speak the same language. Mm. And also at the beginning of that project, I wasn't able to speak English, even like a little bit, you know, I
wow.
had like just a couple of words, which I
yeah.
know. And through that years of conversation, we were able like to communicate to each other. And now I was able even, yeah.
yeah. The WAD Ed language.
He was your own Berlitz language school.
It was. You know, this was a very unusual project. At the beginning, people thought it would last 6 months. It went on for 2 years in terms of the crafting. We ran out of money loads of times.
And well, I was going to say, I mean, how did you manage with that?
Well, sometimes we had to go without. And by the end, we actually moved the edit suite into this strange place where I live in London with my wife, which is like an old derelict church. And okay. We had the edit in there.
Yeah. Can I just say, where was Channel 4 for that part?
Well, no, they were good. It was just because we kept on going back to them and saying, we're not
more
done
money,
yet.
More
we're not
money.
Done. And
yeah.
They couldn't just keep throwing money at it. But
it was
they were
very,
so supportive.
Like, very unusual for them as a process. Usually, like for TV, you had something very specific
and that's it.
And with two very headstrong filmmakers. And they were really like very respectful about that. They give us like the whole
so
time
supportive.
And support.
Right. So this is a real passion project. And
but that was it. What I was just going to say was that the team and everyone in that Channel 4 and Frontline PBS, they were all like, you know, so committed to it because they wanted to honor what these guys had done and what they'd lived through.
So the idea of doing it as a framing as for Sama, I think that was the big magic moment.
The epiphany.
And were you just hanging out having like a little sandwich somewhere?
Exactly. Yeah.
We met in a cafe, which we were like almost like submitted the film for Channel 4 and BBS, and we were like happy. Yeah, it's okay. They were like fully understanding that it's very good. Everyone was almost done. And then we have like a little chat together between us, and the For Sama idea like just come on the table. Mm. And we started like, this is should be For Sama. And we were like, yeah. And then we just like called Hamza, and I was like trying to explain to him what we were discussing. And he's like so tough guy. So we've never like cried or like give us any like, you know, feeling. And then Hamza went back and he said like, yeah, it's good idea. And I can feel his voice, you know, like I almost like I cried, Ed cried,
yeah,
and everyone just
crying.
Like, you know, we were like, we must try this. And we went back to the edit where he was, and we start like seeing just a little bit if that's really work. And it was so obvious for both of us that, yeah, this is how the story should be. And then we called our people and we were like, we want to try again. And everyone was like, we are not sure if that's right or not. And we were like, can we try? And they said like, yes, if you feel very strongly, so yes, go ahead. And we did the first 20 minutes and it was for us like, this is the end. Yeah, that's how the film should be.
How was it before? It was
so it was so much more conventional. So it was chronological in its telling. So it literally started at the beginning of the history and went through to the end. And that meant the emotional arc was just like just a flat line, you know, from up to down.
We didn't change the whole line, let's say. We just change the structure. Right. Everything is in this film. It was in the previous
one. Like Godard, you know, like beginning, middle and end, but not in that order.
Right.
And it also what it did was it allowed the narration and the whole guidance of what was in the film to be unmediated so that you basically became Wad, you know, you become her and you hear her
right
thought
there
process.
With her. Yes.
And so the scenes we chose, then it was very clear. Those were the scenes where you felt that you were in that place physically. And that, I think, is one of the reasons it's so powerful for audiences.
So now I keep waiting for your other child to get old enough to go, what do you mean for Sama? What about
exactly.
me?
That's why, really, I have a plan in my mind about doing the new one. It's called For Tema, but it's not now at all. It's the minute when we will be back to Aleppo.
But I think that's already, Hamza was telling me a great story that they're like having fights, aren't they? Sama and Timer. And Sama keeps coming up to Timer and going, no, look, S for Sama.
Okay, he's already rubbing it in.
She's in her everything. Like.
Yeah.
So whatever she went through, they've got the normal sibling rivalry thing going on. Wad Al-Khatib and Edward Watts are the directors of the Oscar-nominated documentary For Sama. Thank you both so much for coming in.
Thank you
so much.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program, and Paul Smith mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.